Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Let's have a chat about the sharing economy. Have you ever stayed at an Airbnb or taken an Uber taxi ride? Well, they're not taxis, are they? They're shared rides. Chances are you've taken part in what's being called the share economy. It's now worth hundreds of millions of dollars right across Australia. It's got its finger in lots of pies. You can rent lawnmowers, pet sitting services. You can rent your neighbour's garage. Just as on top, of course, of accommodation and your neighbour's car. How much further does it have to go? Should it be encouraged over traditional industries like taxi drivers, hotels and motels? To talk with us tonight, we've got Dr. Jim Menefee, who's with the Grattan Institute. He's the Productivity Growth Program Director there and the author of a report produced last year about the sharing economy and what it needs to grow further. Jim, good evening to you.
Philip, good evening.
And also joining us tonight, Alex Solopoulos is the co-founder and chief executive of Mad Paws. It's an online company which links up dog sitters with people who need them. He's also part of a new sharing economy startup hub based in Sydney. Hi, Alexis. Good to see you in the studio too.
Good to see you too.
Yes. Well, to Jim, can we start with you? How big is it? It sort of seemed to start with accommodation, grew to taxis. How big is it?
Yeah, so if you look around the world, you're talking many billions of dollars at this stage. The leading platforms have got market capitalizations or private valuations in the tens of billions. And there are clearly millions of customers on the accommodation platforms, at least 60 million on Airbnb around the world, probably a similar number on Uber. And on the seller side, you've got at least 2 million sellers on Airbnb, well over a million now Uber drivers. And those numbers scale pretty well to Australia. So at the time we did the report towards the end of 2015, there are already 20,000 Uber drivers in Australia, and I suspect that number would have doubled by now. So you're talking quite a significant contribution to those parts of the economy, at least.
Yes, exactly. And it's happened quite quickly. I mean, maybe this is what goes with technological change. It happens very rapidly, not slowly, as some people say. When changes occur, they're cataclysmic for industries. And some had a view put to me last year that the taxi industry was basically over, they said. Well, that's probably not right. There'll always be specialist hire services for cars, I'm sure. But are we in the midst of a technological revolution that will see traditional services like taxis, for example, a minority player?
So one of the things that motivated us to do the study was just this question: how big could the sharing economy become? And of course, the proof's ultimately going to be in the pudding, but you can see already that going back to the 90s, platforms like eBay revolutionized secondhand sales. And then it was really, I guess, the next phase of the platform revolution is around social media, Facebook and Twitter and what have you. Now, it took mobile smartphones to make Uber and Airbnb really work as business models. And I think that the jury is really open as to how broadly the platform model can displace traditional modes of employment, traditional modes of accessing resources. There are clearly some constraints. So much of what we do when we work is collaborative, and it's in workplaces, and it's not transactional. It's not spot market labour. And so I don't think it's realistic to say that huge swathes of the labour market is going to transform beyond what you already see with about 10% of the workforce in independent contracting. You'll get some more through platforms. But, you know, I think for a lot of us, the rise of the existing mega platforms surprised us. And, you know, there'll be more surprises in future as technology develops.
So that's really my next question. In some senses, it's the $64 question or $64,000 question, isn't it? Is the sharing economy new business? That is it creating new jobs or is it just displacing old ones?
Yeah, I think the way we think about that is that any time you make it easier for a critical mass of sellers and buyers to get together, to find a match, establish a price, and to do business safely, then you're really reducing costs that are preventing mutually agreeable deals from being done. And so in that way, the platforms do all of those functions, often with an extraordinarily low transaction cost. And that clearly cuts out barriers to people achieving what they want to do. And so in that respect, you do get a big upside. But of course, a lot of what they would have done via another platform can also be done somewhat more efficiently on or through a different vehicle can now be more efficiently done on a platform. So it's not all new, but some of it clearly is adding value.
All right, Alexis, you've got a business. I mean, tell me, Uber and Airbnb are big players, but you're involved in smaller players too. I mean, in other words, the share economy is not just big conglomerates, is it? It's also smaller ones. Tell me about what you're doing.
Well, we're doing essentially bed sitting, Airbnb for pet sitting. That's the easiest way to describe it. You jump online and find a local pet sitter or dog walker in your local area, chat with them online, meet and greet in person, and then book them through the website. We, as a website, provide you support, customer support, insurance, and make sure that everything runs well.
Okay. So, in other words, so the transaction is done through your website, though. It's not just done in person. Because at the moment, if I wanted to get a sitter for my dog or cat, I'd look under, I don't know, in the old days, I would have looked under the yellow pages and found one. These days, I could look on the internet and find one. You're saying on your site, your site connects the provider of the service and the desirer of the service.
Exactly. And we see that as a great opportunity because in the yellow pages, you might find a dog walker, a dog sitter, but you wouldn't necessarily see the reviews of previous customers. You wouldn't necessarily be able to filter to only see those dog walkers, those pet sitters that are most appropriate for you. But with technology, and that's, I think, technology is such a big enabler in this collaborative consumption. With technology now, you can actually find those dog walkers that have reviews from previous customers and the ones that have that provide the best solution to your requirements. For example, have a fenced garden, don't have other dogs or cats in the house, have children to play with your dog. And technology can be used in other ways as well in this equation. For example, those pet sitters would send you photo updates of the pet stay while you're on holidays.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that technology is a big part of it. You're also part of a sharing economy startup hub too, where you're also acting as a place where other businesses who want to get into sharing. What else are people trying to share?
Well, a lot of things. But let me name a few examples. Zoom2U is a very fast growing sharing economy business that essentially allows people with a car to deliver goods, do it at a cheaper rate than other transportation of goods services. Another one is storage. If you have some spare garage space or some spare space in your home, you can essentially allow other people to store stuff, whatever they want.
To store stuff there.
In your home, exactly. I like car sharing as well. So the previous one was, by the way, Spacer. I like car sharing as well, which is in Sydney and in Melbourne, car next door. So if you have a car and you don't use it that often, you can essentially rent it out to people in your local area.
Okay. I remember last year while I was broadcasting in Canberra, there was a guy who was trying to develop a rent your driveway thing, car sharing space, sharing space too, when he was saying for people who didn't have anywhere to park in and around busy shopping centres, but you had a driveway, there was a sharing site where you could book someone's driveway to park in as well. Exactly. This is creative new business, isn't it? I mean, these things didn't exist before.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think where there is a need for things like this, sharing economy businesses will arise, and technology will often be the enabler to scale this.
Jim, it is the technology that's driving it, isn't it? I mean, as you said, none of this is possible without computers and the smartphone.
Yeah, I think that's right. And if you look back in history, there've always been attempts to help build trust and to get the benefits from exchange. And, you know, this set of technologies have just permitted an explosion of experiments. Some of them are going to succeed wildly and others will find a fantastic niche and others might wither on the vine. But we're going through a really exciting time and policymakers have got a huge amount to learn from it as well, because policymakers love to think about market design and making things work more smoothly. And here you've got now business operators essentially playing a role much like a regulator, trying to find what the keys are to help people collaborate more effectively. Mm.
Felicity's texted me, and Felicity, hi, on the text line saying, the share economy, how self-serving? Cut out your fellow worker. Self-interest is so destructive. Hello, world. I think a lot of people do approach it from that way, thinking it's a job destroyer. Jim, is there any evidence so far that it is a job destroyer?
Yeah, that was another motivation for the work that we did, to try to understand that, I guess, the balance between new opportunities for people for whom the existing job market isn't working well versus the possibility that people are going to be undercut. And, you know, logically, both things could occur. And so it really comes down to how things are genuinely playing out. There's some evidence that people are using work in the sharing economy to manage volatility in their income, risks in their income from other sources. So they might be doing casual work where they don't have much control of their shifts, and they're able to fit in around the edges of that unpredictable shift work, more flexible sharing economy work. And so that seems like a real upside. But you do also see more anecdotal at this stage evidence of people who are working for firms that are competing with the share economy platform, where the share economy platform doesn't need to maintain all of the terms, the sort of work conditions and salary levels and so forth, that the firm that might be subject to an award is doing. On balance, it looks to us, based on the data, that there's not much of that. Mm-hmm. But in principle, it could become a big deal, and we're certainly aware of instances.
Mm. Okay. 1-300-800-222. Gary's on the line. He's been a taxi driver for 20 years. G'day, Gary.
Good evening, gentlemen. Yes, thank you kindly. Yes, I'd like to have a stab at this share economy.
Yep.
For a start, if it's ride sharing, that would standardise saying that I live at Willoughby, I'm coming to the city. Hmm. You hop in my car and I'll take you. Just pay for the petrol. That's ride sharing. This is a fully fledged taxi business that they're operating.
Yeah.
The ball.
Hey, Gary, can I ask you a question? Do you drive for someone else, or do you own your own taxi?
No, I don't own my own taxi. I just drive off a lease. I just take the bailee. I just bail the taxi out.
Yep.
I've been doing this for 28 years. At the same token, the reason why they're cheaper is these big tech giants, they don't pay tax. Now, 25% of your Uber ride goes offshore in unpaid taxes. Now, this is unfair, and the economy is suffering for this. Most of us are paying 35 cents in the dollar tax. Now, where's the prudence, the prefix for these tech giants to shuffle their receipts back offshore and not pay tax?
Hmm. Have you noticed, Gary, yourself in your end of the business, have you noticed that there's less work around?
Oh, crikey, yes, 35% down. It's all a fad at the moment. People say, oh, Uber, here comes my Uber. In the meantime, there's about 30, 40 taxis go past them, and they might only save about $4 or $5 or $6. Sure, sometimes they're going to be cheaper. When they price surge, they're certainly not. And at the end of the day, my beef is this. Ride sharing is going from A to B, jump in my car, pay for the petrol. That's ride sharing. This is a fully fledged taxi service that they're operating. And at the same time, the reason why they are cheaper, a green slip on a cab, by the way, is $9,000 a year. $9,000 a year for a green slip on a cab. A green slip on a private Uber car is around $800.
Mm. Is there a case, I agree with you about that, is there a case, do you think, Gary, that taxi drivers ought to be getting a better deal here?
Well, of course, look, they need to pay insurance like a taxi does, maybe not $9,000 a year, let's say $4,000 a year. That would just cut out some of the casual drivers that don't have a clue. If they're interested in driving as an Uber, that's fine, but let them be fully fledged and become insured, correctly insured. And for Christ's sake, the government needs to crack down and make these companies, these tech giants, pay their fair share of tax, which goes offshore. They might pay 1% tax in Ireland or wherever it goes, to the Cayman Islands. And there's other groups like Uber, Apple. So there's a lot of big companies that do exactly the same.
Okay. All right. It's Gary, a taxi driver. Alexis, to you. I mean, how do you respond to that when people say that's the trouble with big companies in the sharing economy, that the profits just go offshore?
Well, my profits definitely don't go offshore.
In your business, it doesn't. It stays here. Yeah.
No, look, I get that. And I think when we speak about the sharing hub, at the moment we are very much supporting the Australian businesses, the ones located here in Sydney, Melbourne, Perth, wherever, helping them to grow and to build good consumer experiences for the local Australian consumers. So, look, I understand definitely where that comes from. It is not what we deal with. We deal with the local businesses.
And to some extent, I suppose, you've created a new business as well. Because with the advent of technology and the ability to review people and to share your experience with suppliers, that's a sense of honesty on behalf of those who use and abuse the service, isn't it? It's hard to get away with things in this share platform, because if you do provide a bad service, everyone knows about it because everyone reviews you badly.
Absolutely. And I think this is actually one of the core and most important things of the sharing economy, that review system. People use the sharing economy more and more because the trust in this sector increases. And the review system is exactly that transparent mechanism that allows this trust to be there, to grow. Our pet sitters, for example, we review those reviews very, very closely. In case a bad review pops up, we deal with it immediately. Same with Uber. You don't see 3.5-star Uber drivers on the road. It doesn't happen because Uber is very much on top of these things.
Yeah, okay. Back to you, Jim. My guest tonight, Jim Menefee from the Grattan Institute, who's the author of a big report on policy for the sharing economy and the co-founder of Mad Paws, which is a pet-sitting service. And he's also involved in a share economy hub. Alexis Solopoulos is here in the studio with us tonight. Jim, back to you. I mean, one of the issues that's raised on the text line tonight, it's quite a good question, is the whole share economy just another form of the cash economy? In other words, it's being used by and large to avoid tax.
So the points that Gary made about multinational tax avoidance are absolutely correct and need to be dealt with. It's a much bigger issue than just the sharing economy providers. But you do see...
I've noticed it myself. I've used Uber, and the bill when you get it on your credit card is usually billed somewhere overseas.
Yes, and then they pay their Australian operations a service fee that is just enough to cover local costs. Now, the Australian government's well aware of what they call base erosion and profit shifting, and they've got a number of programs underway to try to recover some of that essentially, you know, inappropriately avoided tax. And so I'm really fully with Gary's assessment on that front. In terms of the participants, though, most of the transactions that are done on the sharing economy are done electronically, and the ATO has got pretty deep reach into banking records. I believe that there's probably less tax avoidance through the sharing economy than there would have been in the cash alternatives that they're substituting
Because that's
for.
An important point, isn't it, Jim? Because it's not actually a cash economy at all. It's because all of the transactions in all of these share platforms are all done online. So therefore, in that sense, they're readily searchable and available.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, there's still cost to the ADO of doing audits and so forth. And so you're relying on people, you know, doing the right thing to some degree, because it is costly to audit. But nevertheless, in principle, there might be, I think it's sort of fair to say, more corporate tax avoidance and less individual tax avoidance than what came before.
Okay, 10:27, 27:29, 27:07 in Western Australia. Get us back to some calls. Sandy, hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Have your guests heard about it's the dinner or meal sharing service, and it's very similar to Airbnb, and I'm not sure if it's going to be run by Airbnb.
What, do you get to eat some of my dinner, Sandy?
Yeah. You can actually go online and look at someone's place and think, oh, that looks really nice, we'll go over there for dinner, and you're having whatever they're having for dinner.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I haven't heard of that one.
Well, apparently it's going to start up, but actually the first I heard of anything like this, I was watching a show with Jamie Oliver, and somebody tried to start it up, and of course it was very illegal because of, council hygiene rules and all that sort of thing. So what they actually did, they got around it by you'd have people over for dinner, but instead of actually charging a certain amount, just before you walked out the door, there was a hat there, and you put the money in the hat on how much you valued the meal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so you weren't actually charging anyone, but at the same time, people were just giving a donation. But as far as reviews go, we did Airbnb for about 3 years, and we've just finished doing it. We did both, but we provided it for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the reviews were, I would never actually go by people's reviews because we got sort of like a lot of good reviews, and we also got a lot of bad reviews, and some of the reviews were just so petty. And just as one example, brand new mattress, $2,500 mattress, and four people in a row we got complaints the mattress was too hard, too soft, too hard, too soft. And so you just roll your eyes and you go, you can't please everyone, you know.
That is true. I guess Alexis, back to you. I mean, that's in a sense the filtering process of the whole platform, isn't it? That people read these things and some people will think, well, you know, that's not going to bother me, or that is going to bother me.
Look, exactly. But I think in this case, it's also the task of the platform, in this case, Airbnb, to investigate those reviews. Mm. And for the Airbnb hosts to make this aware to Airbnb, say, hey, look, can you please investigate this because it doesn't make sense? And then Airbnb to adjust those reviews accordingly.
Hmm. Yeah. All right. Where are we? Just before we take another call, Jim, you talked about the tax issue, which I think a lot of people agree with, and that is, you know, this notion of shifting tax revenue offshore. And to the extent that it's new business and new jobs and new economic activity being created, and of course, some of it obviously is. People are using Airbnb, for example, who wouldn't have ever stayed in a motel, for example. So some of it is new business. The economy is losing if some of that tax revenue is disappearing on us, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the tax issue is much bigger than just platforms. You've got everything from mining companies with offshore marketing hubs to, as Gary the caller already mentioned, companies selling technology here. So there's quite a broad program for the government of Australia, and indeed other governments, to ensure that that companies are paying an appropriate share of tax. So that's definitely one issue. But I think that doesn't take away from the fact that there's a net benefit to consumers from having these platforms that permit really good service to be provided by strangers in an environment otherwise you couldn't do it.
Okay, we're talking about the sharing economy. My guests are Alexis Solopoulos. He's the CEO and co-founder of Mad Paws. It's a dog sitting service. He's also involved in a startup hub for share economy businesses. And Jim Minifee from the Grattan Institute, who's prepared a report on policy for the sharing economy. Generally, Jim, governments haven't raced into regulating this too much, have they? The ACT in New South Wales have certainly said yes to Uber, other states too. By and large, governments have held back from intervening too much with Airbnb. Generally, governments have probably recognised this is a good rather than an ill, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's fair, although when you look around the world, there are obviously conflicts in some cities between existing taxi or rental car operators and Uber or Lyft drivers on the one hand. So that's one issue. The other one is that there have been quite some challenges to city government around the use of existing residential accommodation for commercial purposes via platforms, and that's beginning to bite in some parts of Australia as well. And then the challenges around the labour market regulation are also playing out around the world. There's a lot of anxiety about security of work. Now, as you mentioned, Australia has been, you know, after dragging their feet, the states largely have legalised ride sharing or ride sourcing in one form or another. There's still quite a lot of ongoing discussion about how to get the balance right around the around accommodation. And, you know, I think it's important, though, to recognise that we've got an existing competition framework, existing consumer law framework, existing labour law framework, and you know, much of the sharing economy is subject to all of that, all of those frameworks, and so you don't need to build an entirely new set of regulations to deal with this.
What do you think about that, Alexis? Because another issue that gets raised a lot is this issue of consumer safety. Now, whether it's, you know, safety if I give my pet to somebody that I found on your site to look after it, you know, whether it's I rent a lawnmower that's whose blades are faulty and that injures me, or I'm putting my stuff in someone's garage and they said it's watertight, it's not, and you know, valuable stuff of mine gets damaged. In normal circumstances, I'd have an action against a commercial operator. You know, for those normal consumer protections, what do you say in relation to the businesses that you're involved with about the level of protection they offer?
Look, I think this is super important. I think one of the most important responsibilities of these businesses is guaranteeing quality. It's important for the consumer and it's important for the business. Businesses don't grow when they don't offer quality. It's like that. It's in everyone's benefit. And so all of these businesses, all of the ones that we work with and the ones that are growing, they are taking measures to provide this safety. I'll give you an example on MadPulse. Not just anyone can become a pet sitter. Instead, we actually take those pet sitters through a thorough verification process. They take an online training. They do an online test. They go through an interview process, upload photos, and so forth.
But are you subject to the normal consumer laws? Because after all, they're not businesses, are they?
Well, I think consumer laws are there for a reason. I think everyone should respect them. From our end, we take lots of care on the verification of these people to make sure.
But if something goes wrong, can I sue your company?
Well, I hope you won't sue my company.
No, I understand that, but I mean, sure. but given the legal framework, I could though, couldn't I?
Well, I definitely have to look into this. Into exactly this question, but our responsibility is to prevent things going wrong and to make sure that we took all the actions.
Sure. Yeah, okay. All right, Jeff on the line. Hello, Jeff.
How are you going, gentlemen? Good conversation.
Thank you.
That lady, Stacey, obviously just needs to stop Goldilocks from visiting her apartment. I think she'd be okay.
I think reviews like that, I mean, it's a bit like, I don't know, those other experience rating websites like TripAdvisor. I'm only using these brands because people know what we're talking about. You know, you can read people's reviews and know whether they're the sort of person that you believe or not, usually, don't you?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the point I wanted to make to the panel and yourself was the experience with Airbnb as a host. We've got an apartment on the Gold Coast. We also have a property in Bendigo, which we Airbnb. And it's multi-layered. I think that the point about whether it replaces jobs is interesting, because by having an apartment on the Gold Coast, living in Melbourne, we need a person to do the cleaning, we need a person to manage the keys, we need a handyman on call. So we've actually created, you know, there's an economy of people now who provide these services to hosts of Airbnb, and our cleaning lady couldn't do without it. And she's got four or five clients, and she's making a good living out of ensuring that we get the results we need in terms of the reviews. By looking after the apartment on our behalf and checking people in, etc. So that's one point. The second point I've found fascinating in the disruption is that in big apartment blocks, and ours is in an apartment block with about 45 other apartments, the property managers who have up until now been able to be employed by the body corporate to manage leasing for these sort of properties, you know, really reacted badly to us saying, well, we're not going to use you, we're going to do it ourselves. And they almost put barriers up. So, you know, the disruption goes all the way through. And I guess the final point I want to make before I let you go was the interesting part around setting the platforms and how strict the platforms are with you as a host. And I've, a lot of people have a lot of comfort in Airbnb, and they should, as an example, because the strictness, like if you cancel, you know, a booking, they come down on you like a ton of bricks, and it's a big conversation to have to say, well, actually, we've made a mistake. But it's, you know, there's a lot of compliance that they put in place to protect the consumer from us doing the wrong thing as a host.
Yeah, no, I think that's, yeah, no, good call, Jeff, and I think that's a fair thing. So it's hard, actually, to, unless you've been involved in it, and I have, to understand the power of peer review, in a sense, which is what these online platforms are. They're real, they're live, they're real people, and by and large, if you muck up, then you are quickly found out. Janet, hello.
Yes, hello. Just backing up Gary the taxi driver, excuse me, from, I'm afraid, a rather selfish point of view, I use the wheelchair accessible taxis.
Yep.
They, of course, rely on other normal passengers to make a living. I'm worried, from my point of view, that if enough goes to the unregulated, people won't be able to afford to keep the number of wheelchair taxis there are on the road.
No, it's an interesting point, isn't it? Because I'm not quite sure how the current taxi system works, but I know that they usually tell me that, there's a bit of a cross subsidy on.
They do. They get a I get a subsidy, and the taxi.
A wheelie ride's the same as a normal. You pay the same for a wheelie ride as a normal normal punter would, don't you, Janet?
No, the government gives me a voucher where up to a certain amount of money I'll get 50% off. If it goes over that amount of money, I pay the full fare.
Oh, okay.
But it does help, definitely. And the driver gets a small subsidy. But today I was in my local, and the nearest taxi had to come several suburbs to pick me up because he was the only, he was the one closest to me. So he drove for about three quarters of an hour to pick me up, and I was doing a very short trip, really over one suburb boundary. That's why you need people who are willing and able and have the can still make their living, but drive without making money too. And the other thing, do the drivers of Uber, do they have police checks and that sort of thing? I'd worry about getting into a car if I didn't think that the person had been checked out, like the driver.
Yeah. I think they do have. They do.
Good.
They do.
Yeah.
I'm not sure the extent of them, but they do have. Yeah. They do have some checks. By and large, I must say, at least in some parts of Australia, the cars that seem to be of much better quality than some old bangers of taxis, which is have been around for a while.
I just wish the government had put the same restrictions on Uber as they did on taxi.
Okay.
But thank you. This has been very interesting.
Good on you, Janet. Thank you. And that's a fair enough point too, isn't it, Jim? I mean, people who worry about existing services which have grown up alongside current businesses, which have allowed, for example, in the ride industry, less abled people to make access to have access to transport.
It's a very good point, and state governments will need to change their disability access arrangements because those cross subsidies have been keeping the.
But to some degree, that's a government choice, the decision, isn't it? I mean, they're going to have to say, well, look, if we want people with disabilities to get access to rides, then, we'll have to make it happen.
Yeah, that's right. They'll need to move to a more direct subsidy model rather than the cross subsidy from other riders. But that's eminently doable. And my understanding now is that all of the states who have regularised ride sourcing or ride sharing insist that the same safety checks are done on drivers for all the different platforms.
To some degree, and I like this text that I got this evening too, and Alexis, I'm sure you'd probably, this would chime with you too. Hi, Phil. As a bakery owner, I went through this kind of interruption 30 years ago, along with butchers and fruit shops. Well, that's true, isn't it? I mean, all those businesses have had huge disruptors in them, and they're just normal high street businesses. To some degree, that's what's happening in these traditional, accommodation and transport businesses, isn't it, Jim?
Yeah, that's right. And there's always a huge amount of churn, both in the labour market and in the world of private enterprise. It can be very stressful. And I guess the implicit societal deal that we've come to in this country is that we'll provide a safety net so that the worst risks are socialised. But people are still exposed to upside and downside from all competitive and technology changes. And it is easy to assume that, this is just the fault of the regulators that you get some new entrant. But what's underlying it is that technology gives, a better way to do things. And over time, if the regulators just prevent those things from happening, then we won't get the income growth that permits us to pay for that safety net.
My guest is Jim Minifee from the Grattan Institute. We're talking about the sharing economy, and Alexis Solopoulos, CEO and co-founder of Mad Paws, which is a dog-sitting service, but he's also involved in startups on other sharing economy business ventures too. We're talking about your experiences, and I'd love to you to share those with us too. There are lines free if you want to grab one, or contact us on the text line too, 1300 800 222. Text on 0467 922 702. It's nearly 10:45, 10:45 in Queensland, and 7:45 in Western Australia.
This is Nightlife with Philip Clark on ABC Radio.
Yes, Daniel says taxis and taxi boards were terrible and left themselves wide open, and consequently they only have themselves to blame. I agree on the tax issue, though. Well, I think that's what most of us probably do agree with. You'd agree with that too, wouldn't you, Alex? That if it's a business here in Australia operating and receiving income in Australia, then that people ought to pay tax here.
Absolutely, I fully agree with that. And I think, as Jim pointed out earlier, I don't think this is a problem just in the sharing economy with those larger companies.
No, it isn't a problem in the sharing. Well, it's a problem in the sharing economy, but you're quite right. It's a problem across the economy.
Exactly, across the whole economy.
Yeah. All right, George is on the line. Hello, George.
Good evening, gentlemen, and thank you so much for this discussion. I just sort of came through the door about 10 minutes ago, and I'm very interested in this, and I'll tell you why. I'm calling from Perth, WA. Mm-hmm. I was a taxi driver for about 4 years, night shift here in Perth in the early 90s, and I kind of saw the change of on the streets. Now, just recently, through an enforced early retirement, so to speak, my kids in the 20s said, come on, Dad, get off your bum, get out there and do something. So I've recently started driving Uber.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the fascinating thing is that if I was to be political, I'd say that the taxi industry was troublesome for the last 25 years. The pieces of tin at the front and the back of the vehicle were pushing 220,000 Ks, totally wrong, but there it was. It was a marketplace for investors. Now, the Uber thing came along, and I never even actually used an Uber before, but I'm telling you now, and I'm not being asked by Uber or anybody to say this. I just decided to hit the phone and call you guys. Is this, that I get a great deal of pleasure as an Uber driver, like a lady yesterday taking her from her home with her daughter, a very frail lady, to Charlie Gardner Hospital. She felt totally secure. It was civilized. I was there within 6 or 7 minutes and picked her up, etc. I'm not putting tickets on her myself or Uber, except to say times are changing. And the track record of taxi industry, whether it was Sydney, I've lived there, Melbourne, I've seen it, Perth, I've known it personally, experience, is that the hierarchy of the people who own the taxi company, and there's a large company in Perth, there's a smaller one, they have had such influence over various governments, it's not funny. And I'll tell you what the latest thing is, they're actually putting a penalty on Uber driver, or they're trying to, as of July the 1st or something this year, to put a loading of $200, $300, $400, $500 on Uber drivers because the taxi industry has nobbled the government. But in the meantime, let's get back to the service. I live in the hills behind Perth. We are providing, and I am providing, and I'm trying to provide a day service where people have to go to the doctors, go to the supermarket, go to the shops, this, that, and the other, and they feel totally secure. It's traceability. There is traceability. But at the same time...
Well, the little apps which show you where the car was, they were available to the taxi industry as well, weren't they? And they decided that they'd drag the chain on it. And that, to that extent, George, that's their fault, isn't it?
Well, let me put it this way, and I'm not advertising. People are choosing to have a traceable, when you ring, the old days of taxis in Perth, which you rang up somebody who already had an attitude problem because they were part of this family hierarchy.
That's right.
Yeah, they really were.
And they said, your taxi's booked, and you rang back, and you said, it's not here, and they said, I don't know where it is.
I don't know at what point you'll cut me off, but I'm telling you, that's the truth.
Yeah.
So Uber and any other company that performs as similar or better than Uber is welcome to provide the service because the WA government, particularly in Perth, the transport system is sadly lacking. They keep trying, but they're 20 years behind the eight ball. The Uber service or something similar is providing wheels to get people to A to B, and let's face it, we're population.
The proof's in the pudding, I suppose, isn't it, in the sense, George, that people, if people are using it, therefore they like it, there must be a need for it. George, I appreciate your point of view. We've got to move on because I do want to canvass some other views as well. George raises an interesting point there, though, Jim, doesn't he, that to some degree, the taxi industry itself became, as he said, the structure of the taxi industry became a good place for investors, a very bad place for taxi drivers.
And there's no question
and
that you got in.
That drove half the desire for change.
Yeah, that's right. There, an unhealthy dynamic developed whereby owners of the licences were essentially protected by the limits, and they
and protected by government legislation too.
Yeah, and so you could have seen it play out very differently if the taxi industry had been more open to the technology. But I suspect now that they're really working hard to improve their game because they've got serious competition, and that'll be good for consumers.
All right, Alexis, my texter says online pet services. My dog cannot use a computer, but at least my cat knows what to do with a mouse. Boom, boom. Yes, all right. Where are we? Steve. Hello, Steve.
Yeah, hello. I'm from Brisbane.
Yep, hi.
And I work in the commercial finance industry, and I've got no interest in the taxi industry at all. But I just wanted to say I've got a couple of clients who are owner-operators, you know, that several years ago, or probably 10 years ago, you know, paid, you know, $500,000 for a license which was regulated. And, you know, I'm not defending the taxi industry, but they had to meet legislation and guidelines. And some of these guys, you know, viewed that as like superannuation. And I've got a client in particular who I know who's, you know, put in the hard yards for, you know, 15 odd years. You know, his half a million dollar license, well, $2 million was basically superannuation. And now he's 70, and look, the state government's talking about giving him $25,000 compensation per licence now.
Yeah, no, I get that, Steve. Can I put this? I'm just being a devil's advocate here, though. I mean, in a sense, that's right. Someone's taken a punt and had an investment. The investment didn't work out.
Yeah.
You know, to what extent does everyone have to underwrite that? I mean, if I buy a unit, for example, and the price doesn't go up, do I get the money back from the government?
Well, the thing is, though, like, if it's supposedly a regulated industry, like 500, like a big difference, there's a big difference between 25,000 and 500,000, right? You know, like, it's easy for people to say that sort of thing. It's happened also up here in the news agency industry, like, they're businesses now that no one wants, but it's just a changing time. But you know, I don't think the public, and more so the politicians, really understand that it's destroyed the retirement of some of those people's lives, you know, and look, you know, you argue about you bought a property somewhere and, you know, and bad investment and it's gone pear-shaped, but this happened really with, you know, beyond their control, and you really couldn't say it was bad management. It was more, you know, legislation and governments allowing people just to come in and do what they like.
I mean, there is some sense in what you say. What do you think about this, Jim? I mean, the governments have a responsibility to shore up the investments of people who have gone bad?
Yeah, it's quite heartrending to see some of the capital losses that people have experienced. I've spoken to quite a number of them. And ultimately, it's a social choice question. The community has got a lot of alternatives looking for taxpayer funds, everything from hospitals for sick kids through to environment protection to new roads. I mean, you name it. There's a long, long list. And I don't have any special expertise about where people facing this kind of capital loss fit in that hierarchy. Most governments around the country have offered, you know, similar level of compensation to the ones that the caller just mentioned. So it could be $20,000 for the first couple of licences. You know, I don't have special expertise to say whether that's the right number.
I agree. There's a particular problem. What do you think, Alexis? Do you, in that particular instance, people who bought taxi licences in good faith, as it were, should they be compensated?
Well, I think it is indeed a social question. Should they be compensated? I think it's a government question. It's a question we should all think very hard about. I personally feel for these people, so I would be in favor of this. Also because it impacts such a large amount of people, for sure.
Yeah, okay. All right, Matt's an ex-taxi owner on the line. Hi, Matt.
G'day, mate. How are you?
Yeah, pretty good. Well, thanks.
Yeah, I got out of the army in the very early 90s and pretty much got out with a pretty good sum of money, so I went out and bought taxi plates. Did the whole making money and doing what you got to do as a taxi driver, and upgraded to a silver service and did that for about 8 years.
Did you make some capital improvement on the plates?
I paid 160 for them, and I sold them for 380.
Okay,
nice. About 15 years later.
Uh-huh.
The writing was on the wall, basically, because what happened with the taxi industry is the meter fare kept going up and up and up, and once it got to about $1.20 a kilometre, it just sort of like skyrocketed after there and made it not cost-effective for people to catch taxis anymore.
Hmm. I mean, that was true, wasn't it? I mean, taxi fares did become ridiculously expensive, didn't they?
Well, I caught one the other day from my work to home at 6 kilometres, and it cost me $18 to get home. Now, I don't care because I had to get home, but, you know, a pensioner can't afford $18. And the other thing was, back in the early noughties, what was happening is there was too many owners with plates and cars that were available and not enough drivers. So they started bringing 457 visa holders in to basically fill those cabs. So I don't know if what happened in Sydney and other states, but in Queensland, all of a sudden you found these Sudanese drivers and other drivers from other foreign countries with very basic English, GPS, brand new uniforms, and basically they were paying for them to become taxi drivers in Australia.
Hmm. Yep, there were. Thanks, Matt. I mean, look, there are many, many issues in and around the taxi industry. I think they've been well discussed. Lisa makes a point. Jim, I'd like your comment on this too, because this point's been raised about Airbnb sites, and that is whether or not the popularity of them has raised rents in some areas, because people think, well, I can rent the place out for so-and-so, so for so much a night, to casual travellers on Airbnb. That's much more than I'd get in a weekly rent if I tried to rent it to someone. So therefore, rents have gone up. Is there any evidence that this is actually the case, apart from the accusations?
So if you're in downtown Paris, you might see a material effect. But even in a city like Sydney, where down in Bondi, you might have up to 15% of properties listed as available for at least part of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd think, gee, that must have made a big difference to rents in that area. But it's important to recognise that Bondi was always, has long been a bit of a tourist mecca, number one. And number two, that the total stock of housing in a city like Sydney would be 50 times Sydney's rental housing capacity, and maybe 200 times if you think about sort of bed nights. So a demand increase of, even if it was all incremental from Airbnb, just wouldn't be big enough to push rents up across Sydney in a material way. And there have been some studies in the US estimating, you know, increases of maybe $20 a month in a city like San Francisco.
Hmm. Okay. Kevin, hello.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Well, thank you.
I just want to make a comment on the legal liability. I think you asked Alexis about that earlier on.
Yep.
It's really very simple. It's just strict liability. So if there's a problem, you would sue the operators. You would sue the person that, for example, if you're sharing a garage, the owner of the garage.
Can I sue? I'm not wanting to sue Alexis, but for example, Alexis.
No.
I mean, can I sue Alexis, who, after all, owns the platform or runs the platform that I got the garage from?
Absolutely. So let's talk about Uber.
Yeah.
If somebody gets attacked, like, you know, we may have seen incidents in the past, if, you know, people are getting attacked in a taxi, just, you know, random attacks or whatever, then Uber would get sued and the driver would get sued as well.
Right.
And but the owner of the car would also be a party to, could be a party to the action as well. So some Uber drivers rent cars from another organisation because Uber has a recommended minimum number of years, you know, like age car.
They tend to be relatively new cars, yeah, yeah.
Mm. Yes, yeah. So the person that rented the car, or the company that rented the car, the driver and Uber would all be up on the action and would get sued. And obviously how that, you know, pans out in the court. Everybody who does, you know, platform sharing, need to understand it's great to, if you're making money, then you're opening yourself up for liability in some way, shape or form.
Mm.
Even if you're not making money. It's just simple, strict liability. And of course, we won't really know until something happens. And I mean, some businesses, look, Uber is probably a very large business and probably, you know, well structured and they've got good funding. But, you know, some of the smaller competitors out there, you know, they may not be survived, you know, an action. Some people, just like normal business, you know, a normal business may not survive an action.
Yeah. No, no, I get the point. Thank you, Kevin. Interesting thought, too. I mean, Jim, you were wanting to chime in there?
Look, I'd just add that if it's clear to the consumer that the platform is merely a matchmaker and that the service provider is an individual on the other end, that I don't think, as a matter of consumer law, that the platform would be held responsible for poor service or fraud by somebody on the platform.
Okay. All right. Look, we'd love to keep talking about this, and I know everyone would too, but we are sadly out of time. But thanks very much for your time from the Grattan Institute, Jim Menifee. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Philip.
Appreciate it. And from Mad Paws, which is a pet sitting service, the CEO and co-founder, Alex Solopoulos, who's been with us this evening as well. Thanks, Alex.
Thank you very much.
Good luck with all the businesses and all the sharing hub. More power to everyone. More enterprise means benefits for everyone, I think.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.